Welcome to the Free Cities Podcast. My name is Timothy Allen, and this is the official podcast of the Free Cities Foundation. Hello, and welcome to episode number 80 of the Free Cities Podcast. Well, today this will be my last episode before our next fact-finding trip to the Czech Republic and Liberland. Very much looking forward to that. I've heard so much about Liberland, and up until now it's all been theoretical, so I can't wait to actually see for myself in real life what is going on there. I also have already secured some excellent guests from the wealth of interesting speakers at BTC Prague this year. It will, of course, be fantastic to hook up with old friends and colleagues there in the wonderful city of Prague. Location, of course, for our own conference, Liberty in Our Lifetime, this November. Link for tickets in the show notes. Anyway, back to today's show, and my guest should need little or no introduction. He is the renowned architectural theorist, educator and author Patrick Schumacher, probably better known currently as the principal architect at Zaha Hadid Architects. They are a renowned architectural firm known for their innovative and futuristic designs, which utilize organic forms and especially cutting-edge technology. Those of you who follow the Free City space closely will also know that Zaha Hadid were actually commissioned to design customizable buildings in Prospera, and we get into that in the conversation. Did you know, however, they also designed Liberland's metaverse city? Well, you do now. Anyway, this interview was part of our SEZ film once again, so there's somewhat of a slant in the direction of special economic zones. But don't worry, I'll be talking to Patrick again at Liberty in Our Lifetime in November, so the conversation should flow more freely then. FYI, we do actually jump straight into the chat discussing the City of London, just in case that isn't immediately apparent while you are listening. Anyway, I hope you enjoy our conversation. If you'd like to send me questions or feedback, well, guess what? As of today, I have actually got a dedicated email address that will come directly to me, podcast@free-cities.org. That's right. Drop me a line anytime. My inbox is always open to you all. And in the meantime, while you're furiously typing away your feedback, why not take a short break and sit back, relax, and enjoy my conversation with Patrick Schumacher. Just out of interest, as a free man of the city, do you get any, are there any benefits to that?
No, but it's of course interesting that the politics, the political framing of the City of London, of the Square Mile here, the financial district, is allowing that amazing dynamism and freedom to generate fantastic real estate assets, to accommodate and reaccommodate continuously all the banks of the world in ways which would be absolutely impossible in any other part of London due to political constraints. So the City of London, accident of history, similar to Hong Kong, exists with this medieval constitution where the business associations and businesses are determining the politics and planning, and not, and because also there are some residences, but not that many, which would establish or establishing everywhere else, and nimbyism, which is blocking everything. So here we have this political system which allows for something exceptional, which is amazing, beautiful, I think, dynamic, but also very high value.
So if are there any people that live within the limits of the City of London then? And if so, do they have a say in anything that goes on within the city?
Yes, there are residents. For instance, the Barbican is within the bounds. But the number of residents is dwarfed by the number of businesses. And so the businesses understand that the overall business dynamism and development dynamism of the city of Mountain is allowing everybody to benefit. And therefore, you don't have NIMBYism. You have a can-do, should-do attitude. And you have this kind of fantastic pile of most sophisticated, super high-dense architecture with fantastic spaces for all these banks and consultancies and law firms. And at the same time, I think they show what you can do. They can have all of this and still all the historical assets, because they're really an appreciated asset. They live on in the historic complex of the square mile. And I think that's a great example. And then you could call it a special economic zone, special political zone, perhaps.
My, just like I say, not necessarily as part of this film, but I'm interested in your opinion on the Barbican itself as an architectural thing, because yeah, personally, I'm
well, the Barbican is an era from a different era, where this kind of tabula rasa approach of clearing out our district and building new was seen to be more viable than this now. But I think it is, has its own qualities. It's actually private in its residences and residential products, and therefore has a relatively high quality. It's interesting. It's mixed use. It has all these arts venues, and so I'm positively tuned to the Barbican.
Do you think that the building of it was involved in any shape or form with, or was it any different from a building that would have been built like in Notting Hill, for example, at the time, like Trellick Tower or something like that? Do you think they had any special advantages building the Barbican because it's inside the walls of the city?
Yeah, I'm not aware of that. It's an interesting question, perhaps. I think I'm relatively critical of a lot of the government-sponsored housing estates around the country. So the Barbican is not one of those.
So in that sense then, when you want to build a building in the city, you said you've had dialogue. Yeah. Who do you go to? And then, for example, who pays for it? So if it's not the state paying, is it the City of London that's generating the money to pay for the housing, for example?
No, I mean, it's mostly private. And we had some private clients, not for residences, but for small offices. And the point being that there is still planning, a planning system, and a chief architect. It was also interesting, there's a personality who had a lot of respect and power and determination, and still is. But the underlying, you know, bureaucracy was basically pro-business, because the whole politics is pro-business, because that's where the majority of the, if you like, councillors or freemen who established the political, let's say, base group and popular sovereignty, if you like, in that part of London, which is very different from other parts of London where you have the residences in charge, and they tend much more towards NIMBYism.
And another question that's making me think, I've never thought about this before. When, say, someone in the city wanted to build a large tower, would they have to negotiate with people outside of the city for any kind of planning restrictions?
No. The planning is, they have their own planning authority and planning jurisdiction. There's one thing that I think is going beyond that, which is St. Paul's Cathedral viewing corridor issues that affect large parts of London, including there. But I don't think it affects the city so much. I think at that point, there is a general kind of rule which covers everybody in London. Other than that, I don't see any... The boroughs of London are independent in their planning jurisdiction. And that is sometimes, with respect to all the other borrowers, actually a problem, because you have the locals in charge, and therefore certain things which are catering to the whole of London is shifted around, and nobody wants to have them. That's why in London you have actually the mayor of London, with respect to important projects, can intervene and override the local boroughs and their planning officers, not almost calling in the project. There's even the chance of the central government to call in projects. So the UK planning system is such that they realize that there are problems, political problems with development in these kind of local democracy conditions, which they needed to have a mechanism to break through that, which is this kind of representing on a larger level. Still, London is trying for 40 years to build a third runway in Heathrow, and it seemed to be incapable of doing that, etc., etc. And also a large project, perhaps something like the Shard, the mayor can take it out of the hands of the local decision-making process. So they realize the problem and found these mechanisms. But it could also sometimes even backfire. We had a project in Vauxhall, a twin tower project, which was stuck in planning for so many years. Then market condition changes, the investor pulls out, etc. You finally get planning, and then in this case, the central government calls it in. Although we had local planning, they actually added to the problem, and we had to get another round, etc. So this could also sometimes go both ways. But my overall experience in London is that a large part of the excessive real estate costs, which hampers the economic development of London in terms of housing costs, and some other periods it was also office cost, was really a constraint and to be attributed to planning restrictions.
What, in your experience of urban planning, are the worst aspects of urban planning that, the biggest problems not addressed in most of the current systems that you work?
One huge problem is the restrictiveness to begin with, for instance, of land use allocations, and that they're pretty much frozen and rarely adjusted. So the historical development of the city and the way the market would want to allocate and optimize land resources is kind of frozen up. And therefore, what you can't easily get is the kind of emergence of synergy clusters. And therefore, you can't, if you find a site, you're not free to make the most of it. It's already determined what you can do here. And on the other hand, if you want to bring something particular to the city, you can't find the site you would be optimal for you. You can only go to sites where this type of problem you want to do has already been put down in some kind of general plan. So that's a huge problem. Second problem I see, density restrictions. So that there's an artificial barrier to develop more. And finally, there's an enormous amount of restrictions on, for instance, particular residential, on the unit mix that precisely prescribed the size of each apartment, minimum sizes, size of each room, all the facilities you have to offer, and all of that makes the product more expensive. And it also makes it, worsens the product market fit, because politicians often want to have larger apartments with more rooms, families, even though the huge pressure is actually on small units or single individuals, but they're not politically catered for. So this is another big thing. But also on top of all of that, although there are all these restrictions, the planners reserve the right to discretionary appraisal. So there's an enormous amount of uncertainty about what they will or will not prove. And that's a huge barrier also of entry for outsiders. So that restrains the development market, because only local insiders have a fighting chance to or can take that risk, actually, to purchase certain land, because they can appraise and understand the intricacies of the particular planning authorities, the particular planners and councillors, and what they might get away with or not to appraise the value of a site. But even then, it becomes uncertain. So there's been examples of outside investors really hurting and burning because they didn't realize that they couldn't just do what they maybe considered to do. And then they're forced to work always with locals. So that means you get a kind of an artificial monopoly of local embedded, who then also can't go outside because there are other locals. So the whole real estate market is kind of frozen up in this kind of kind of artificial monopoly structures in every city where this is prevalent. So that's a huge problem, and we've seen that. It's really hampering the process here.
Can I just ask a quick question? When you talk about synergy clusters, you were talking about synergy clusters, because I know in Dubai they have special economic zones and then they have clusters of businesses. Is that a synergy cluster, the one in Dubai, or are you talking about a cluster of things naturally just occurring?
Well, I think they could be naturally occurring, but they can also be steered, I would say, by entrepreneurs. The city of London, the financial sector, is obviously a huge synergy cluster. And similarly, they're usually spontaneous orders, where you have aggregation of business which relate to each other and find each other's co-presence beneficial. You also have the West End with the media cluster, etc. And they could be set up to try to make that happen, but that's obviously not always easy and to set off. And I think the best recipe for the emergence of synergy clusters, which are actually about optimization of value, of land values, and also utility, is degrees of freedom in the development process, I would say. The more degrees of freedom, the more you can involve synergy clusters, possibly, an owner of Free City or somebody is managing and setting up the free zone can steer that a little bit. I would think that's possible to accelerate that, or giving information signals. Here might be a chance to have a media center or a financial center, and that helps that process. But then again, I think what should always be open to allow something unexpected to emerge. And any restriction of this freedom of space allocation, I think, is potentially obviously preventing benefits of trade.
What do you think about Dubai and some of the Emirates making media city, publishing city, etc.? Would you call that a cluster?
Yeah, I think these are the attempts to create these kind of synergy clusters. And I think that's fine. I mean, but it's not totally restrictive. It's just a kind of guidance of, which then people can realize, oh, probably others will come here. We've personally set up shop in the design district, Dubai. And that, because we were expecting, and that also turns out to be correct, this branding helps to forge that synergy cluster. So we were in a building where, we had Foster and Partners in the same building and other architects, and the design festival is taking place. So curating a synergy cluster, that's an entrepreneurial task, which also municipal governments could do, and that's useful. They're rarely restrictive in the sense that you now, if you're not a design firm, you cannot, take up space in the design district. I don't think that would be the case, but sometimes they might, for big buildings, or when they oftentimes you can curate a district by looking at the kind of additional benefits which might come if you bring a certain tenant in, an anchor tenant or so on. So you would be selective and not say, you know, whoever is paying the highest price at this point will be looked at. I think that that's why sometimes good to have this additional entrepreneurial management layer, perhaps, to curate an overall value proposition. And this was actually the way London used to be developed through the great estates. They were private and there were many competing great estates generating city districts. Well, these were the old aristocratic landowners who set up some kind of planning and leasing bureaucracy, in inverted commas. The first planning was this kind of private planning. And I believe in that. So this is maybe potentially more effective than just leaving it all to kind of a spontaneous emergent order, because that might also take time before something crystallizes. So this kind of curation, private planning curation, I think is helpful. That's what we also propose when we work with free cities, free private cities, that one can have a mix of regimes, including private planning, just a curation of synergy clusters, for instance, and some kind of basic structure for others to fit into with more certainty, with more self-reinforcing certainty, rather than, you know, it could be faster and more effective. But then we also always been saying there should be some zones where you let it rip and be free, because maybe what you think would be a good curated value mix, then we are limited by that mind, by that plan. So that plan should never be restrictive. So to be light-footed, agile plan, but also allow areas where this plan is much kind of less expressed. That's what I would recommend.
So the three things you mentioned, the kind of planning, you know, clusters, density, unit mix, all this kind of stuff. How do you rectify that outside, in somewhere like the UK? Is it possible? Is it possible to reform?
No, I think that? What is very important is that you set up fresh somewhere, ideally, where you don't have incumbent interests in world of commerce and preventing, I mean, where you don't have a condition where interest patterns are frozen up and transformation generates too much friction. So fresh start has always been important, and you can see that in the history of city development, that there's sometimes these very fresh cities kind of zoom and flourish. Detroit, for instance, a certain era, out of nowhere from 0 to 100, etc. Other places like Singapore, of course, were mentioned, and Hong Kong through special conditions, but also in general, sometimes you just need a fresh start because the existing mature places, you just have too much incumbent interest, there's too much friction, too much, you're stepping on too many feet, like you're infringing on too many stakeholders and get resistless for something new. And of course, there's a balance to be struck, because you also, if you go to existing cities, of course, you have already infrastructure, you have already new labor markets you can tap into, and so on and so forth. But we never underestimate the chances of new developments mushering up. So there are the pros and cons for that. And definitely when it comes to very dynamic, we're also looking at a new era with new dynamics. For instance, when we shift to post-Forest Network society and neoliberal era and globalization, we have oftentimes new places having a chance, having a go.
According to with your sort of architectural eye then, if you look around the world, what would you say is the most successful architectural place of recent times? Where's done it right? Where's done it well?
Well, I mean, I go back to the square mile as being amazing. And I think I have a lot of hope with Prosper, Honduras Prosper, as a newfound city, which is just having a go. Getting started, but also there's this kind of example of Gurgaon outside Delhi as something which just utilized a vacuum, put a power vacuum and policy and politics vacuum to generate something quite dynamic and quite compelling. It also showed up the some kind of drawbacks you get if there is no guiding structure at all. So these are interesting experiences. We can see in Dubai, of course, is amazing experience. Shenzhen has been amazing experience historically, and they still have, I mean, special economic zones that were amazing. And from a fishing village, which I've still seen the beginning, kind of the early beginnings of, out of that, I've saw when I was there in the mid 90s, and what happened since, and now we have a technology giant, of course, a population which is super young and dynamic, and now still special zones within the special zone, allowing for additional global players to come in and settle and competing with Hong Kong through special dispensation, etc. So we are now, or have opened the Shenzhen office, and we have so many major projects, major corporate headquarters, and there are many in different districts. We're actually doing some bag buildings and technology company buildings, etc. And it's unbelievable what Shenzhen was able to do. So that's a great example. Dubai, Shenzhen are the kind of highlights. Singapore as well, where we also have a number of projects, and it's still kind of pumping. We've developed a whole master plan, One North, for industry clusters. It was also a multi-program cluster. So we had an IT cluster, a biomedical cluster, a finance cluster, and we developed a kind of open grid for mixed use with very few restrictions. The very young, kind of in the late 20s, early 30s, government, fresh and dynamic bureaucracy helping us, giving us a lot of scope. And it's been growing. This was happening in the early 2000s and has built up nicely and beautifully. And a great example I would point to, One North, Singapore, as a really dynamic and successful kind of industry park cluster. Well, it's really a city district which emerged.
Can you describe the projects you worked on in Shenzhen? Were they, and have
what? Yeah, so we do Oppo headquarters, for instance, for the major telecommunications and mobile phone company. And yeah, there's a lot of freedom. Unimaginable that we get away with that in London or in Germany or so. So we did something quite extraordinary. We have a kind of cluster of towers, and we pulled out the core with the open playing field on these floors and scooped out an atrium and have a highly kind of futuristic expression. It's just all glass. So for transparency, then you can look from one tower to the other and be part of the city. And it's within super headquarter base, or the cluster, where they also curated, bringing a lot of tech headquarters. And we're doing, in the same area, we're doing a very tall twin tower, so-called Tower C. That is actually outside with the government investment. So we'll be multi-tenant, where we have two towers with bridges, which open terraces, mixed use, retail, galleries, art galleries, offices, all mixed in. And again, I think there's something we on that scale, I think the Chinese authorities and clients, they give more scope. They're less kind of constrained and constricting. And therefore, that's why they get these wonderful projects done and done, get them done quickly.
I was going to say, can you describe the experience of planning in Shenzhen versus planning in, say, Lewisham or something?
Well, I mean, there's something we'd also expect from, you have mayors and district mayors who are entrepreneurs, really, and who you can talk to and clients can talk to and flesh out. There are constraints, there's a base plan, but I think there's the end of, there's not too many layers of prescriptions and bureaucratic kind of hurdles. So it's a streamlined process compared to everything we are used to here. I mean, the equivalent project, quite a bit smaller, but also twin tower project here, the Vauxhall cluster, took literally, and we're still in plan. We got planning after 4 years of continuous reshuffling and renegotiation, unclarity, uncertainty, said, then we had, as I said, investors got tired and so I swapped out. Now it's still depending on land for transport. We at the moment don't have resources to do a bit of land swap, which was agreed, et cetera, et cetera. So it's kind of a nightmare. This project should have long been ready and be in the market and, you know, help that supply, which the government and everybody else is crying out for. But it isn't. It hasn't even been started on site. And that's 5 years in. So in the meantime, we're finishing, you know, the Oppo headquarter tower and quite a few other towers. And in Chengdu, we have a whole kind of district we generate, a kind of incubator. It's called Unicorn Island. It's all about startup companies and incubating industry clusters, a whole district, which is kind of in the dot to finish on with construction, while we haven't even started construction on the London project, while they start more or less, they kicked off in parallel.
What are the limit of the restrictions that you face then in, say, Shenzhen? Presumably there are still restrictions.
Of course, there's sensible. There's also restrictions which come out of, you know, the physics, fire regulations, etc.
But other than that, like...
Of course, you do have an overall GFA stipulation, but it could also be negotiated. And there's no interference so much in the appearance, although it is also, you have to show it. I'm just saying, maybe on paper it looks similar, although they don't have, you know, public consultations, and you know, they can also bundle the different authorities better. But in just the experience is much more streamlined. Even though on paper it might look as if it still has all the ingredients of it. What's the planning process?
With regards to like planning regulations, what do you think is a planning regulation that affects normal people that they probably don't know even affects them?
Yes, I mean, well, it affects everybody because the product you're looking for isn't been supplied. So there's enormous supply restrictions coming out of the planning systems that just don't release land or don't allocate land to the most urgent demanded uses. And this is politically directed supply, but it's also the amount of supply. But also it's the product itself. So, I mean, the government here is presuming it can define minimal requirements of a decent apartment. And in my view, for political reasons, because they have had such standards and they're gifting away for social housing, etc., these standards, they can't reduce them. Although the market would be perfectly willing to snap up and go with, well, it's the smaller apartments, the apartments that maybe don't have the same, all the equipment which is required as a minimum standard. But it's particularly also the size standards, which are, very excessive compared to what the young professionals who otherwise are now forced to live in bed sets and share flats. So in fact, saying that this product, which for instance, some entrepreneurs, young entrepreneurs, try to bring in the market under the heading of co-living, is rabbit hatches and indecent. When they say things like this, they just prevent something and the alternatives are not there, as these people cannot afford that larger apartment and they don't get subsidies. So it's just the kind of politics of prevention. And in reality, those very people who they want to protect are sitting in overpriced bedsits in decrepit, in rundown ex-council flats and paying $1,000+ for a single bedroom if they share the flat. So there's a huge issue. So it affects everybody. And it affects particular people who are building their career and want to come to metropolis like London, where all the work is, where all the excitement is, where the career development potentials are. So they are affected because their material life standards are plummeting and compromised, and they have to live in these kind of nooks and crannies. And so that's really, really, really a problem. but also businesses. Businesses who are forced to make tough decisions about being part of this and paying, you know, an arm and a leg for the space and the employees for their patches, or going to a provincial place where they don't have these costs, but they are kind of disconnected, not fully connected into the hub where things are happening. So it's a very tough decision, very difficult to make. And it might be a mistake to be comfortable, but disconnected. So that's, I think, and the more these conditions push people away from the place where they should be to make the most of their careers, knowledge, and entrepreneurial resources, that means overall economic development is stunted, because it's not easy to open up a new place. And also, we're now in England, even these new places, once they're discovered and people want to aggregate there, become quickly too expensive, because there's supply restrictions there too. So you could have made the decision, you sit somewhere in Croydon, which is kind of, away, and it makes it harder for you to just quickly go to the pub after with your colleagues, or go to that exhibition opening or that conference quickly and then walk home, and et cetera, et cetera. You sit in Croydon, where you get, and as the small cluster build, it runs up the prices again, because supply is just simply not coming forward. So the flexibility of supply, wherever it needs to be, and let that grow fast, that's what the market would deliver. That's what you would see in a free private city.
How important is autonomy in the process of building in a place?
Well, I mean, autonomy, I mean, I think what is important is that those who want to offer something to society, those who are in touch with and have intuitions about the end users and the requirements maybe and the vision for a new product, that they are free to deliver that, to try it out, rather than being forced into delivering a product which is predefined to somebody else. So in this sense, I'm not sure what to call autonomy, but yes, I think the developer should be not be prescribed, should be autonomous to develop a product he wants to bring to market. And that's at the moment is not happening.
You're working alongside, or you're working with Prospera. How much autonomy have they given you?
So, yeah, we as architects, we don't want autonomy about the essential, let's say, offering. That's the client. The client is hosting a new audience, a new facility, they need to be autonomous, first of all, and unconstrained by their some kind of political process or political incumbent interest. But as architects, our autonomy, which I think in a professional relationship with the client, what the client should realize, while he is establishing the life process he wants to host and describes that and has a vision about who he wants to bring, who he wants to cater for, and what kind of services and life conditions he want to establish for them, he should leave it to the architect to translate that into spatial organization, articulate that architecturally and visually and in terms of technical functionality, etc., and social functionality, where the purposes are defined by the client and the means are autonomously defined by the architect. We also need autonomy. The problem is that in the current political conditions, the client is constrained with respect to purposes, and then on top of that, the architect is constrained with means, so politicians, so mistrusting of any entrepreneurial freedom, constrain both purposes and the means, and don't grant any of the players any autonomy. And that's a big problem. So we want autonomy, and the mature client usually grants autonomy to the architect, so that they can actually get the most. You know, that's why they're calling for expert advice, and somebody with a lot of versatile experiences and resources and ideas to then bring the best, and wouldn't second guess necessarily how we could best realize what he wants to deliver to end clients.
In the case of Prospera, what happened in the process with Prospera that couldn't have happened elsewhere? I mean, what have you come up with? What kind of innovations have occurred?
Yeah, so we engaged on a number of levels. One was early on thinking ahead, and that's still something which is on the cards. How an urban pattern could evolve, what planning regimes in the plural also one could think of that would give some degree of guidance and framework and vision, and at the same time a lot of degrees of freedom to those who would kind of settle and join that venture. So that was on the level of urbanism, urban planning. And then on the other hand, we also came in as architects with developing a particular product of a kind of cluster of villas, but also with some shared social space, etc. And for that, we also developed a very unique product, which we actually also want to roll out as a startup company, which is a process based on a menu of modules we developed and a site, instead of delivering a finite finished product to the end user and to market, inviting potential buyers into a process of discovery of participatory design, where they can collectively, in each other's view as well, I mean, as a group of buyers, knowing who else is coming, can make selections, see what others want to select, maybe want to share space with some of them or want to be close to some of them. It's kind of a dating site and community building process at the same time, emerging and developing the product with this much better product market fit, but also allowing the synergy clusters to emerge, which in the wild can emerge through trial and error by people buying something, moving out, somebody else moving in, but accelerating this and using a digital virtual anticipatory process of building that community, building and optimizing for the final outcome through placing of bets on options and selecting modules, which are remain flexible until you finally go start construction. But even then, thereafter, there's an open-ended process. And that is sort of unthinkable, I would say, in the usual planning regimes, where you get too many prescriptions, where you have to tell the planners exactly what you're planning to build ahead of time before you even get permission and go to the market. So this kind of the planners for planners in the usual ilk, it would be a nightmare that something is emerging that can't kind of redetermine. But of course, an entrepreneur would love to see that, and we want to generalize out of that, and we hope we can make show the productivity of that in Prospera. So there's also this element of modular construction where we have local, we bring in a local small robotic factory. And one can imagine that also this building doesn't have a finite end state, that you can substitute models, that you could add modules or add to the cluster. And again, planners wouldn't have any of that. They have a complete scheme before you even go to any market. And then also, you know, you can't add to this because that's final. So with these kind of in Prospera, I think we get a unique possibility, opportunity to do something exemplary and dynamic and interesting, and hopefully add that value. There's this added value of bringing together people and entrepreneurs, probably most of those who come there, who also come to a place because of each other, particularly when it comes to companies, that the value of the site isn't just simply the site that it's close to a station or have you, that it's close to all the other players who are coming. So location is a relative location to all the, you know, it's bootstrapped out of its own, you know, let's say, agglomeration where everybody is everybody else's reason to be here. And that's the kind of thing we want to accelerate, anticipate. And for that, we need that degree of forging the entrepreneurial process unencumbered by political constraints.
Is it true that on Prospera, the robots you were talking about are printing building materials on site? Is that
yes,
right?
Yes, there's 3D printing of elements. There's also timber fabrication, robotic timber fabrication, milling of timber elements, on site. Yes.
Describe the printing of building materials. That's something I've never heard of before.
Because we have this system of modules, is all these modules are not necessarily rigidly fully defined. They have degrees of parametric variation, and therefore the components put them together to the final adaptation. Therefore, they can be final adjustments through the fabrication process. So once this has been agglomerated, you get these geometric adjustments, and then you build. So the components are not a totally fixed kit of parts. They are so-called parametrically framed kit of parts. And that's easier and that's possible if you have robotic fabrication, because it's just about reprogramming the G-code a little bit to make this final adjustment. So, and printing, particular concrete printing, is a highly ecological way of dealing with this. You don't need steel reinforcement. You can make these relatively lightweight elements, and that is labor saving, and therefore it makes the whole process more agile and just in time.
Is it used a lot elsewhere?
It is starting to emerge more in China. They're building all houses with that. We have some experimental buildings. We produce bridges out of components. I mean, yes, it is happening. It's not yet obviously pervasively used. And again, there's issues of maybe an overcautious regulatory environment in mature economies, where they go kind of maybe too many extra miles before you can use a product that has to be certified at XYZ. So what is good about a new place like Prospera, that one doesn't have to be that conservative, particularly isn't yet, and if problems emerge, one can react to this. And that's the problem with a lot of innovations in the construction industry of new materials, etc., that there is a bureaucratic process which takes an enormous amount of time and resources, which is probably over the top and maybe protects the big players and kills off or stunts all the smaller new players which try to get into market.
In your experience, have Prospera got a first mover advantage, do you think, or not? Is that a real thing in this kind of way?
Probably is. There's a certain initial, I think, market for mobile entrepreneurs who look for unusual degrees of freedom and are willing, therefore, to go a bit more remote. And, of course, the gap in degrees of freedom between California and Prospera is huge. But there's also a gap. They can also go to, Texas first and find degrees of freedom there. So I think that definitely is a pull factor. But first mover, yes, because there's a footloose group of people who are aware or maybe looking and who can catch the most urgent seekers of freedom first. We might have that movement. But I think this is also about generating a whole network of experience around the world. So I think there will be first mover advantage, but then I think there will be others who can follow.
Do you think that special economic zones and on their evolutionary journey, do you think the characteristic of them as a testing ground for innovation, is that an important part of what they are?
I think that's the primary reason that for special economic zones, one of them anyway, the primary ones in China in particular, it was that they had a vision for possibly new way of organizing economic life, of offering new degrees of economic freedom, etc. And they wanted to try that out, not full scale across the whole country, but try it out in local conditions. And I think that makes a lot of sense because the risk is also reduced to that local context. You don't put the whole country at risk. Maybe it was unclear how people would react. The problems which might arise, that there were some interesting flowering issues in the early economic zones. And So, and there was also boom bust cycles early on. So that was where it makes a lot of sense. Not the only. It's not the only, wasn't that? Another one is obviously potentially that to develop an area of the world where you need special points of attraction. So to bring in foreign investment funds into country like Dubai or financial institutions. And again, the requirements this group needs, you don't want to necessarily roll it out as new opportunities to use the frame for everybody. There's also speculation, if you say, in England, this whole idea of leveling up and developing areas of the UK which have been decaying, and there are some industries which are receding, like the coal industry, ideas of special conditions, special regulations and freedoms could also be that. And so I see these two things, trying out innovations, and if it goes well, rolling it out, or bringing investment and economic life to places which otherwise wouldn't easily attract that. So giving a competitive edge to an underdeveloped area.
What do you think, where do you think are the most exciting places around the world currently for, I mean, I'm looking at the wall behind you here. This is straight out of the future coming down to the earth, you know. Uh-huh. Where are the exciting places now and why are they so exciting?
Well, I mean, for us, it was China and now it's Saudi Arabia in many ways. So it is the kind of injection of investment, of visionary exploration, of building whole new places, cities, is quite amazing. So yes, so Saudi Arabia is definitely interesting on that front. And there will also be special economic zones, if you like. And we had it before also, I mean, there's always been zones of special dispensation, special rules. Even in Saudi Arabia, for instance, when you're talking about research clusters or universities, people who are invited there are not necessarily under the same law and restrictions and rules like everybody else. And I think some of that is also happening in NEOM and in other parts of Saudi Arabia. And I think it is also then, yes, maybe using that also as an area of experimentation to roll out. But it's definitely an interesting, exciting dynamic which we find in Saudi Arabia at the moment. And they, of course, compete with Dubai and Abu Dhabi. They all want now, or we become the place to go for regional headquarters.
Why? I mean, if you could sum it up, why has Dubai been so successful?
I mean, definitely as a financial center and trading hub, it was just very liberal and allowed in deal making and trades. I don't know, sometimes you need the initial bootstrapping, I think, is the difficulty. And so there was the initial investment, I think, also to make it happen and break it and kickstart it. And then it was rolling and kept rolling. Of course, there was setback in 2008, and it took a while to return. So you could also have, you know, waves of irrational exuberance, let's say. Yeah. But what was amazing about Dubai, I think, is that if you think about the Arab world and in general, in the era when Dubai was starting to rise, there was no example. We had the first world, second world, and third world. The first one was basically Europe's, Western Europe, and the Anglo-Saxon commonwealths, or let's say, you know, the Anglo-Saxon settled areas, and there was only Japan. And the rest was either second world, or sort of, you know, the communist bloc, and then the rest was third world. And Dubai was showing that there could be an Arab first world country, you know, and that gave a lot of signaling power and became kind of pole of attraction and inspiration for much of the Middle East. So I think that was an important world historical event, I think, for the whole Arab world. A beacon of pride and possibility.
Do you see, if you look back since, you know, well, the first special economic zone was of modern times in the 50s, say, Shannon, places like that. Do you see a trend of evolution or of need? Like, you know, I if do, so?
Yes, I think, first of all, yes, I think there are thousands of special economic zones, and they should keep proliferating. You need to experiment also with jurisdictional setups, with, you know, business framings, etc. And it's a healthy competition also. So where you should be able to learn and imitate. Therefore, there need to always be new zones, or zones need to reinvent themselves. And it's sometimes hard to have a whole country reinvent itself. These processes are too slow and too cumbersome and too much of friction and, you know, vested interest. So I think this world becoming more dynamic, becoming more innovative as we go and faster, we need more special economic zones. And I think that's plays an enormous role, important role for the whole progress of world civilization or world society, that these zones are happening, exploring ways of doing business and ways of establishing contemporary life. And I think that's enormously important and will continue and should expand.
According to your experience then, in those kind of places, what's good advice to a country or slash government who are thinking about going down that route? And I'm not necessarily talking about the traditional economic zone. I'm talking more about somewhere like Prospera, maybe, or Morazan, or, you know.
Well, I mean, I'm identifying with leaders, and there could be political leaders. A lot of, you know, the political inertia isn't attributable to the leaders, who maybe had a part of aspirations and drive, idealism and energy, but it's hard to realize reform when you have institutions which are frozen, if you like, and too many moving parts and too many vested interests, and are not enough agile responses. So the advantage of the special economic zone is, particularly when you open up a new piece of territory, that you can do something and explore something. And I think the signaling of successful developments, they will then kind of make any rollout much quicker. So I would say it's really for politicians who also don't have, you know, eternal power, eternal life, to get something done within their countries, to focus on, you know, and carve out these special economic zones, and then also buy into the expertise of investors and specialists in political economy and in development. I would say this is an amazing opportunity which becomes more widespread now as an option for development. I think particular, you know, development economics is a big topic, and it's been overall fraught with so many difficulties and frustrations. And I do see that special economic zones are a very vital and important mechanism to overcome those. This is what is otherwise kind of quite disappointing, frustrating inertia and difficulty of development.
Do you think, can you see a progression from here? What do you think the future is of those zones?
Well, I mean, what I find so fascinating about the ZEDE law and the ZEDE framework in Honduras, which unfortunately is under some kind of pressure at the moment, is that it opens up space and brought forth some new types of entrepreneurs who can think holistically about the overall setup of a society for prosperity. And of course, that's it's a big step. There wasn't anybody around who had, you know, that product of a whole kind of systems of laws and courts, all the things which usually provided by governments who are only in their traditional territory. To see a market for, you know, on a level of fundamental principles of living and working and flourishing together with all the ingredients I think that's where I see the future. And of course, this is a new market. There to build up that expertise and product and have product awareness, we're in the beginning of that. But that's where I see the future. And there are, of course, not many players around because it's really something which needs to be built up first. But that's like what excites me about this space. So special economic zones plus where you have, you can do more than just tax incentives, for instance, or a lower income tax rate or cut a few regulatory hurdles, import duties, etc. The usual menu of special economic zones, not to make that, to denigrate that. I mean, that's been very important and very successful. But what is that special economic zone more ambitious and aspirational concept of a special economic zone? Like we find Tipolis or players like that, and there's also academic discourse feeding into this. So we're now having a movement and the discourse and a community who are excited about a global community of entrepreneurs and researchers and thinkers who are excited about this possibility. And yeah, that's what I really find exciting as well. And that's where I see the future of special economic zones.